Welcome to Between Two Ovaries, your go-to for all things women's health.
And a lot of people just say like, oh, my vagina.
Yeah.
And yes. That's not your vagina.
No.
Well, it is.
I'm here to cut through the confusion, bust some myths, and give you the facts straight from the experts.
You cannot still believe the amount of people that come to a gynecology clinic saying that they don't look right down there and they need something doing about it.
We're keeping it real, bringing you honest conversations about topics that matter to you.
Everything goes back to the menstrual cycle.
Yes. It's a low-risk procedure, but it's not a no-risk procedure.
From periods to menopause and everything in between, we've got you covered.
So whether you're here to learn, laugh, or just listen, you are in the right place.
As soon as I said it.
Hi everyone, welcome to this very special episode of Between Two Ovaries called Eat to Ease, about nutrition for endometriosis with our very special guest, Christy.
We thought this episode was really important because we know that endometriosis is so common. It affects 1 in 10 of reproductive age. It's an estrogen-dependent chronic inflammatory condition. And we, at the moment, haven't got amazing treatments for it.
Yeah, so obviously there's we can offer pain relief, hormones, surgery sometimes is appropriate, but there's actually a lot of other symptoms that we potentially can't improve with our toolkit that we have as gynecologists.
Yeah.
And there's also other aspects, so nutrition can help with alleviating some symptoms of like bloating, constipation, diarrhea, and we know that a lot of women with endometriosis also have a massive crossover with irritable bowel syndrome, yeah. IBS, and so we really wanted to sort of give you more insight into the alternative ways that symptoms of endo can be managed alongside hormones if they're necessary for you and surgery if it's suitable as well.
Yeah, so let's invite Christy on.
So a very warm welcome to our very first special Between Two Ovaries guest, Christy.
Woo, woo!
Christy is an accredited practicing dietitian. She has expertise in endometriosis and is the founder of Christy Lee Nutrition. She and her team are based in Australia and they help endo warriors from all over the world inside a flagship digital program called Beat the Endo Belly. And that rapidly reduces pain, bloating, funny poos and fatigue. So welcome, Christy.
Welcome. So we're going to get straight in. We've got quite a lot of questions that we want to get through because we think this is a really interesting topic. So we thought we'd first start with what sparked your passion for nutrition and what led you to focus like specifically on endometriosis?
Ooh, such a good question. And I'll try and keep it as short as possible. But when I was starting out in my work, so I spent the first 5 years of my career as a dietitian working in GP practices. So I actually had 9 different practices I worked in. I was traveling all over Perth at the time to visit all my different clients wherever they were located. And during this time, I started to really fine-tune what I loved about nutrition, who I really loved to work with, who really inspired me and kind of got me out of bed every day. And this took me down a road of falling down into women's health, pregnancy, fertility space. I found that so fascinating. And then also equally into the gut space. I loved IBS. I loved funky poops. And that's my word for like constipation, diarrhea, because it is funky. And I decided one day that this kind of more generalized space probably wasn't where I was feeling like I fit anymore. And so I just packed up all my bags, went out on my own and started a business. And I'll tell you, they do not teach you how to run a business in university. I'm sure you guys know this.
No.
So I didn't know what I was doing for sure, but all I knew for certainty was that I was starting to see more and more of the people I loved. And when I started out in this space, it was like generalized women's health, generalized gut health. What I didn't expect was the amount of people that would come to book in with me who had at the time undiagnosed endometriosis. Mm-hmm. And so what I was finding in my assessment was that they had these gut symptoms, they had awful menstrual symptoms, and they were all related to each other. So they often synchronized together. So someone might experience worsening of their bowel symptoms with their period. And for many of these people, they had never heard the word endometriosis. And I was often the first person to even say, have you heard about this? You sound like a classic case of endo. So it was through this experience of helping these clients to get a diagnosis, because when this came up in the consult, it often brought up a lot of tears, a lot of frustration that these symptoms had been brought up in previous consultations with health practitioners and they were pretty much just brushed off. They were either sort of told period pain is normal or that, you know, it's kind of, you know, they were made to feel like it was all in their head, that the level of pain, they had low pain threshold or tolerance. And so, you know, to just take some ibuprofen, to take contraceptive medication and let that just kind of be the end of the road. And so I think for a lot of people, the first person who really kind of dug a lot deeper, I went and wrote letters back to their doctors, got on the phone, started talking and trying to get them through to a specialist gynecologist. Yeah. That was even just something that for a lot of people, they were denied the opportunity to have. And many of them were diagnosed with endo, which was such a relief for them. And I guess through this process, I just ended up becoming a little bit crazy obsessed with endo. I don't know. I just kind of like got like wrapped up in this world. I became obsessed with researching about it. I found it fascinating how common it was, but no one seemed to be talking about it and how much support these people needed to even get in the door with a doctor about it too. So I just decided that that was clearly my area of specialty and where I really wanted to put a lot of my time because it was so rewarding for me.
That's great. Really good answer. It really kind of puts it into perspective so that we can understand where you're coming from. Can I just slightly take this on a tangent already? Do you think it's getting better? Do you think you're seeing people that know that they've got endometriosis more, or do you think you're seeing people that come to you thinking that they potentially have endometriosis? Is the system changing? Are we improving?
Definitely, and I can only speak to my experience here in Australia, but definitely in Australia, when I started out doing this 5 years ago, so I've been a dietitian for 10 years, but 5 years when I started my practice, and people didn't seem to know about it.
Yeah.
Then it was about 2017, which actually was the year prior to me starting my practice, a huge grant was provided by the Australian government into research and awareness and advocacy around endometriosis. And that the findings of that research started to come through over the next few years into the early sort of 2020s. And we started seeing education happening in schools.
Yeah.
We have endometriosis care clinics now located all across Australia. We have at least 20 of them, if not more now. So these are centres that they're GP clinics where people know it's like an endometriosis safe place.
Yeah.
You know, when you go there, they understand it. You won't be told that, you know, you're crazy if that's the, you know, best way to put it. Mm-hmm. And so through even, I guess, a lot of media on the news now, we get a lot of news articles now about endometriosis. So I do think the awareness is increasing and people, I find, I mean, now that I work in endo, people come to me because they know they have endo. So I don't often see the undiagnosed people as much as I used to, but it is getting better.
No, that's great. I just kind of wondered whether the tide had changed a little bit, because I think we see more people that will come to you saying, I think I have endometriosis, rather than coming with the symptoms and you saying you might have endometriosis. I think it is slightly changed now. Mm-hmm. And I think it's way more popular. It's way more in the media. We see it a lot more,
and it definitely does show that. So it's obviously brilliant that you have advocated for the people that you've been involved with from a work point of view, but how important it is to advocate for yourself, and to do that you really need to have more kind of education, and a lot of that is finding information out yourself, unfortunately, through things like this. So that's another reason we wanted to kind of do this episode specifically on nutrition,
because there's so much stuff and be like, oh, actually, these are the symptoms I'm having.
Yeah,
yes, like, I thought this was normal.
Okay, well, I'm sorry to take it on a tangent already, but I just thought it was interesting to see how the times had changed. So it's good to know, though, that things potentially, I don't know if they're improving treatment-wise, but people are more aware, which is always a good start, I reckon.
Yeah.
So many of our listeners are really curious about the connection between diet and endometriosis symptoms. Is there a specific dietary approach that can really make a difference? So these are the patients that kind of, I feel like we see so many women that have come, like, had lots and lots of surgeries, and they've had, or surgeries aren't for them, or they've had hormonal treatments, they want to come off hormonal treatments because they'd like to be pregnant. pregnant, and they're like, what else can I do? What else is out there? And I think that's the area that actually, as clinicians, we find really difficult, because we're kind of like drilled into certain lines, and we know that surgeries and hormonal treatments aren't the answer for everybody, but I don't think that we are great at saying what else is out there.
We're not very well equipped to talk about the other things, I think, generally speaking. So yeah, it'd be great to hear what you have to say on that.
Advice about that.
That's what the allied team is here for. So, and you're right, I think people are just thirsty for self-management strategies that as you said, surgery medications, they have their role, but they don't often empower the client or the patient to help themselves or to be empowered, to take action on their own health. And diet comes up as probably one of the number one things people start to consider. That's what I see. I mean, I'm sure, like, when we look at sort of exercise and other physical therapy, that often comes as a recommendation, which is wonderful. But a lot of people don't get the recommendation of diet yet. And I think that's kind of like becoming more and more well known or popular. So when it comes to eating for endometriosis, what we understand about the symptom drivers of endo is, one, that it's a chronic inflammatory condition. And so this is why we see a huge benefit to using anti-inflammatory diets to help reduce the inflammatory load on someone's body. We also know that there's hormonal imbalances in endo, so there are different diet and lifestyle strategies that can help to find more regulation with hormones, both like menstrual cycle hormones, but even like, for example, insulin regulating blood sugar levels, and stress, so cortisol hormone. And then we also know, and we'll talk about this probably in a few moments, but there's also often a big population of people with endo who suffer with gut issues or digestive issues. We know that about 90% of people with endo suffer with at least bloating, and around about 70 to 80% that may experience either diarrhea, constipation, or both. So when it comes to the diet stuff, there's actually a really great systematic review that was done a couple years ago in 2022 that looked at what available research we have on diet, and they came down to kind of two ways of looking at it. So for the people who have digestive issues, it's worthwhile considering either a low FODMAP diet, a gluten-free diet, or a low nickel diet, which is kind of a wacky one if you've ever heard of that. I don't personally love it. It's very restrictive. I don't find it very just user-friendly. Now, if someone has digestive issues, it's worthwhile exploring these diets to help relieve digestive issues before taking on an anti-inflammatory diet. Okay. Now, if someone has no digestive issues or they're very mild, it's worthwhile going down more of the anti-inflammatory route. And so step one is to look at upping antioxidants, upping minerals like calcium, magnesium, vitamin D, healthy fats like omega-3, for example, and limiting things like saturated fat, trans fat, processed foods. And so when we think about that kind of dietary profile, I hope we all start to think of the Mediterranean diet, because that diet promotes anti-inflammatory benefits through whole foods, reduction in, highly processed or red meat intake. And it's not to say we can't eat those foods ever, and I'll talk about that today too, because that's a problem. We don't want to extremely restrict our diet, but if we just want to lean more into that kind of anti-inflammatory eating. So everyone, I believe, should follow the Mediterranean as a bit of a baseline diet. And then for people that have unique types of symptoms, we might consider other dietary strategies to tailor it to their symptoms for relief.
Okay. So when you, I think just for listeners and for ourselves as well, you're saying about antioxidants and you're saying about these different vitamins and minerals, are you using this in food, or are we using these in like extra supplements?
Great question. Now, supplements should always, my opinion, be to supplement a really great baseline of nutrition and lifestyle habits. Yeah. And it's for a couple of reasons. One, when you eat nutrition from food or whole foods, you're not just eating the nutrient, you're eating the way that it's packaged. And so the way that food or nutrients are delivered can be, for example, when you take some, say you have an apple has fiber, it's got water, it's got all these other things in addition to being high in vitamin C, for example. And the delivery of vitamin C is always better absorbed and better utilized by the body when it's delivered in a whole food product. But there is always a place for supplements. There are just some nutrients we cannot reach the ideal target with from whole foods. And or it could just be that the dietary preference of someone won't allow us to meet it. So a great example of this is that someone may, and many people hate fish. People, a lot of people don't like seafood. They don't like the flavor of salmon. Right. And so we know omega-3 is a great source of anti-inflammatory fat. But if someone hates fish, then we might need to consider a great supplement to support them in place of that. And then there are certain other supplements that we, for example, NAC, if you've ever heard of that, mm-hmm. N-acetylcysteine, really common one that we might use in endo. Again, trying to get target levels of that one from food sources, very hard to do.
I think so. Eleanor said she's not heard of that.
No, I've never heard of
it. It seems quite like a bit of a buzz thing at the moment, I think. I think you hear it quite a lot. Do you not think, Christy, or...?
Yeah, I mean, it's so funny because I spend my whole day doing this stuff. I'm like, yeah. Everything's, I just hear this and I see this, talk about this all day. So, I mean, I hope, I guess it's getting more traction. But yes, N-acetylcysteine, it's an anti-inflammatory nutrient. Mm. And it can, there was a study that would show that it helped to reduce the size of an endometrioma cyst. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think it's particularly buzzy. Look, and it is only one study. We'd love to get more studies. Yeah. So anyone, you know, we're clinging on to anything we can. It's not harmful to take. So people do or are very interested in it.
Yeah, the fertility patients like it as well. Like it's it is definitely one of the like buzzy ones around.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. So with endometriosis and people that you see, what are the biggest misconceptions you encounter? So are there any food restrictions that are completely unnecessarily strict, like cutting out a total food group like gluten or dairy or that kind of thing?
100%. I would even go as far as to say, I think that any approach that 100% cuts out or restricts anything is probably unnecessary unless the person has an allergy or food intolerance that is proven through a proper diet elimination and rechallenge protocol. And so what I see happening a lot on the internet is generic blanket advice. So the most common things are gluten-free, dairy-free, red meat-free, soy-free, sugar-free, caffeine, alcohol. And I just call this like the cutout diet. Just cut. We might as well just not eat anything.
Sounds really boring.
I mean, who could achieve that? It would be
so difficult. How many things all these stuff are in. You're left with like fruit.
No. You say that, and then if you're someone who's into cutting out sugar, then you're like, oh, I can't have fruit. And then there's kind of like raw diets and keto diets.
Yeah. And a restrictive diet like that, when you're someone who's suffering with endometriosis symptoms, who, you know, it's already have an impact on your life and your mental health. Yeah. And then to try and take something that for most people is probably like a real joy, food. Yeah. Take that and make it so restrictive that, you know, you're really struggling. I think it would be so hard to stick to. Yeah. Even if it was proven to show benefit, something so restrictive. Yeah. It'd be so hard to actually stick with it. Yeah.
One of the biggest takeaways that anybody could take from this podcast episode is that a body cannot heal or thrive in a stressed or calorie or nutrient deficit state. Mm. If your body's hungry, if it's not receiving proper nutrition, that inflammation just thrives on an environment like that and it just gets out of hand. So anybody who's going down these rabbit holes of restrictive eating may find themselves skipping meals or, you know, just, I guess, under eating in general. And that just adds more stress to the body and takes you further away from the initial goal, which is to reduce pain. And so if the goal is to reduce pain, we actually want to think about how can we nourish ourselves rather than what can we take away and, I guess, starve ourselves.
Yeah.
Can I go on a slight tangent, actually? Because I think this leads in really nicely to a lot of people will get their information about dietary advice for endometriosis symptoms on social media. And you must see a lot of incorrect information on there because obviously a lot of it is just trying to get likes and views. What would you advise to people who are, because I think naturally a lot of women will go to social media to get their information. Is there any kind of advice you would give them to kind of eke out which profiles are accurate or not, or anything to just avoid when it comes to dietary advice for endo?
Yeah, so key. And look, and I, we are also on Instagram, and so you will still also find great, qualified, reliable practitioners on Instagram too, and that's what makes it confusing, because we are out there. It's just that there's probably less of us, and we're maybe not as good at marketing, because I think the typical, like, young influencer now, damn, they've got it. Like, they know how to make a viral reel that gets tens or if not hundreds of thousands, even millions of views. And the average health professional spent most of their career studying the thing that helps you, but it wasn't the thing that gets the big likes, or it's not the maybe the sexiest type of content either. So this is a challenging space. But if someone's on any kind of social media platform, always try to find out the person's qualifications. And often it's in the bio. So if it's Instagram or TikTok, there's a little bio at the top of their page that says a little bit about them. You'll often need to look for, like, specific words, like maybe dietitian or doctor or physiotherapist. And if you don't find it clearly enough there, because remember that the bio has only a limited amount of characters, and if you're wasting it on things that maybe aren't the thing you should be doing to get people coming to your page, then you might need to click through to their link in bio or their website and just go and read their about page, find out where did they get qualified. Was it a university? Do they, are they accredited with regulatory bodies?
Have they got a certificate from the
evidence? No,
that's great advice, actually. I think that's really useful.
It is really difficult though, because there's just so much misinformation, and I don't think actually we understood, well, perhaps Eleanor and Lorna understood it a lot more than Alison and myself. But when we started doing this, like, the stuff that's out there is ludicrous. And I was like, how is anyone listening to this? But I don't know. As you've said, these people are kind of just better than us at kind of getting things out there and telling you not to have a smear, or telling you to not have it. And you're just like, don't be crazy. Like, you need to do this. And it's part of, I don't know. And then there's, like, people that are against medical advice. And you're like, but honestly, we've studied for a long time. Like, we see people and we help people. We're not trying to not help people. It is a difficult space. I think you're totally right about trying to make sure that your evidence is backed up if you're getting
it
online.
It's hard when people have, like, doctor in their profile, but really they're not a doctor of medicine. They're a doctor of something else.
PhD somewhere, but it's not actually a medical situation.
And they really don't have the qualifications to be given the advice that they're given a lot of the time. It's not always right. But it does trick people.
It's scary. That's what it is. It's just scary. And people listen to the information that they like, and that it's probably achievable and that makes sense in their head, I suppose. But
enough, it takes quite a bit of work to, you know, if they have found misinformation rather than accurate information, to try and break that down, then it takes a bit of work. It's quite difficult. But yeah, it is good that, like, you're on social media and, like, we're getting out there There's a lot of stuff. Yeah. There's a lot of, you know, trying to combat the misinformation. So there is a lot of good stuff out there as well. But yeah, that's really useful to try and find the useful, accurate information
accurate
on social media.
You
kind of touched on before the low FODMAP diet. So we know, obviously, with women with endometriosis symptoms, very, very often have similar symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome, and the two cross over quite significantly. Can you just sort of expand a little bit more on what the low FODMAP diet is and how it helps with those kind of symptoms?
Absolutely. And this, so we had a great study come through in 2017 from Monash University. This was what really catapulted awareness around the low FODMAP diet's use in endometriosis. And essentially what they found was that 75% of people with both endo and IBS-like symptoms respond to a low FODMAP diet. So that's about 3 out of 4 people who see an improvement in digestive symptoms. What is involved in this dietary strategy? First thing to know is that it is not a long-term diet. It's actually a short-term experiment. That's the best way to think about it. So it works in 3 phases. Phase number 1 is where we reduce the amount of FODMAPs in someone's diet. That doesn't mean we cut out FODMAPs, it means we reduce them. And so usually there's a tolerable portion of most foods. There's only a very small amount of foods that we actually limit potentially altogether just in that first phase. And so what we're looking for in phase 1 is an improvement of symptoms. And with my clients, I'm always saying, okay, out of 10, we're looking for about a 3 or less out of 10 for digestive symptoms, because it is normal to experience some amount of digestive changes every day, a bit of gas, bit of bloat, it's normal to fart, like, you know, it's not to be like completely without any digestive movement. Like the gut does make noises.
She grumbles. Mike's like, my ears.
It's coming.
What does FODMAP actually stand for?
Yeah, I was going to ask.
Ooh, yeah, sure. So look, it's an acronym, and you'll see why we shorten it. So fermentable, oligosaccharide, disaccharide, monosaccharide, and polyols. In short,
easy. What's a saccharide?
A saccharide is a chain of sugars. And so when you put sugars together in a chain, they become a carbohydrate. So the easy way to understand what this is it's just a group of carbohydrates and sugars that don't digest well in our gut. And actually, most people, to some extent, don't digest them. And we've all got a tolerable limit. So if you've ever had a huge bean soup with garlic and onion and maybe you ate it 3 days in a row, and you'll notice your gut is like super loud, like it's making all the noises. And maybe you're a little bit constipated or you have diarrhea, depending how you respond. So that might give you a bit of an idea.
Beans. This is all for a reason. Yeah, definitely.
I love talking about poo, if you don't already know this.
So do we, even though we're gynecologists. It's a huge part of our lives.
It is.
And so everyone has a tolerable limit. Now, in a body with endometriosis, we see that people have higher levels of inflammation and more sensitivity to their gut. So we call this visceral hypersensitivity. It means that they're more aware of the nerves or signaling coming from the gut. So when these farty foods enter our gut, the sensation of the distension and addition of water and essentially motility or movement changes through the gut are more sensed by someone who might have endometriosis and IBS. So that's one piece of it. We also know that there are gut bacterial differences or imbalances in people that have endo as well, and this can make them more susceptible to the sensations of what these FODMAPs do in their tummy. So the FODMAP diet, just to summarize, do not do it forever. We actually go through a second phase of bringing FODMAPs back into the diet one by one systematically. We look at a small, medium, and large portion to figure out at what a portion you tolerate that food. And it helps us just identify what is someone's unique food triggers. Because once we can essentially unlock that knowledge for someone, it then tells us when we implement their anti-inflammatory diet, what do we need to be a little bit more careful of? Because a lot of anti-inflammatory foods are also FODMAP foods. And if we add in a big anti-inflammatory diet, sometimes for some sensitive people, we end up loading them up with FODMAPs, which make them feel worse.
Oh, that's really well explained, I think. That'll be really useful for people listening.
Yeah.
That's one of the diets I'd heard of associated with endometriosis, but not. I didn't actually realise it was just something you try short term. I kind of assumed you're on it forever and that's it. So that's really, really useful.
And
thank
also
you.
I didn't know that it was like in a fight in a way with having the anti-inflammatory diet, like, so you need to be kind of careful, I suppose, that you're treading a fine line in between them.
Definitely.
Okay. Lorna?
Yeah, so one of the things that we're hearing more about, I think, is the endocrine disrupting chemicals and the microplastics that are sort of in the food supply and the water supply. Do you think these might play a factor in endometriosis symptoms, and is there anything people can do to sort of try and minimise them, relieve them, anything like that?
Definitely. So there's actually a pretty good body of evidence now that has looked into endocrine disrupting chemicals. So this is like BPA, PCBs, dioxins, coming from plastic, coming from even waste products or pollution from spraying of crops, for example. And so what we understand about these chemicals entering the food supply is that they can disrupt hormonal balance. They can increase oxidative stress or inflammation in the body. And so if someone is looking to use this as a strategy to improve their symptoms of endometriosis, they can consider a couple of things. So number one is that if you want to reduce how many plastics you have in your food, you can look at either choosing more jar or glass containers. So for example, like jar tomatoes or beans and legumes and things like that. If you're using cling film on your food, so trying to swap that for healthier alternatives, like you might see even like beeswax filming. I don't know if anyone's seen any of that.
I've got some of those. They're great, silicone. Actually. They last a really long time.
They've always got a nice pattern on them.
Or silicone, yeah.
It's just better for the environment too, because it's not single-use plastic, so you'll use it again and again. And you can use silicone as well as an option. You can also look at, for example, the containers that you use for heating up food, because it's usually the heating of the plastic where they start to leach a little bit faster. So all of your Tupperware, if you can start to look at how you can be switching to some glass, porcelain or stainless steel Tupperware containers to store food, or at the very least empty it onto, you know, a porcelain plate, put that in the microwave before you heat up your food is a really good strategy. Another really interesting one is dioxins. They accumulate in the fat tissue of animals and dairy products and fish, for example. So someone who eats a really high fat diet tends to have higher levels of dioxins that may increase in their own body fat as well. And so these are associated with more inflammation, more hormone imbalance for people. So simply just trimming your meats or buying low fat options when it comes to meat. And I know this is controversial and it's very like, you know, depending on who you talk to, but dairy, whether you go for low fat or high fat, if you're talking about dioxins or endocrine disrupting chemicals, lower fat is a better option because it will contain less dioxins. If you're looking at fertility, we have research that shows higher fat fertility is better for hormones and things. And so it's a bit of a mess, but look, it's just be like, I just kind of go on a case by case for that one.
And I think we sort of touched on it briefly a minute ago about sort of like vitamins, minerals, supplements. But are there any that you find are really specifically helpful for people with endometriosis symptoms and maybe ones that you're like, please stay away from them, never touch them?
And most people come to work with us and they're already on like a long list of stuff. Is condense what they're taking because it's often too many things, or they're doubling up on things they didn't realize. So, if I had to pick out my top three things that I think most people could generally benefit from, number one, a really great quality women's or prenatal multivitamin, because it just contains a great range of the B vitamins. It contains zinc. It often contains like a great amount of vitamin D. And so all of these things can really help with inflammation and hormone balance. If I mentioned before omega-3s, I see like that's probably like the number one that I always recommend. Omega-3 is a great supplement to take, and magnesium, which can help with menstrual cramps. It can help with sleep at night and even help with the nervous system and reducing anxiety. So they're like the top three. I would warn people about one thing. So if you're taking a multivitamin, be aware that if you're taking anything else, that you're not doubling up. So I see people taking zinc and a multivitamin. There's an upper limit of tolerance for zinc, and if you go over that, there can be adverse effects. And the same for vitamin B6. And B6 comes up a lot in hormonal health. If you have too much of it, it can cause nerve damage. So it's always good to get a health professional to check what supplements you're taking, make sure there's no interactions with medications, you're not taking the upper limit of anything, and that you actually need to take all of them because they cost a lot. And then you might just feel like you're eating capsules for breakfast.
That's really interesting, because I feel like supplements, I'm always like, oh, they must be good, like chuck a few more on there, like a sprinkling of something on top, and I'm like, no, that's so bad.
I agree, though, in the fertility space we see this loads, and people have come and they've started with like a prenatal vitamin and then they've just added and added and added and added, and by the time they see you, I'm like, oh gosh, there's a lot of stuff. I was like, you probably just need to take the pre-pregnancy vitamin is probably enough for most people. They add and add. There was a piece done about men and increasing their sperm quality, and there's a couple of vitamins about, and reactive oxygen species. And they were saying that if you're taking like a few of these different medications, that actually it can make it worse rather than better. I think it's that, as you said, kind of maybe asking when you're going to sit down with somebody and saying, would you recommend me to take three?
Is this actually a good
one?
Idea?
Yeah. I was going to say, are there different vitamins that might clash with each other that you shouldn't take at the same time?
Yeah, I think it's kind of more
go on.
Yeah, look, definitely. Look, iron's a really common one that we need to consider if someone has heavy menstrual bleeding. But iron, as many of us might know, it interacts with so many nutrients. It interacts with magnesium and calcium. So I personally look for a good women's or prenatal multi that doesn't contain iron so that we can actually take it at a separate time away from the multi, because the multi will have magnesium, calcium, zinc in it, and all of that compete for absorption. So it is worthwhile considering sometimes that you won't absorb every thing if you take it all at once, so the timing can make a difference.
So do you ever collaborate with other healthcare professionals like gynecologists or psychologists, physiotherapists, to provide like a more multidisciplinary care pathway?
Definitely. I mean, when we think about endo, it is a multifactorial condition. It affects multiple aspects of well-being, between mental health, physical health, nutritional health. If someone is to really thrive with endo, they need to be thinking about adding in different people to bring it their approach. And I don't want this to overwhelm anybody listening, and we certainly don't want people to do everything at once. I often recommend to people to focus on seasons, and so really kind of either journal out some symptoms, then kind of bring attention to what maybe are the key symptoms affecting you right now, and then think about what health practitioner maybe is the best fit to give you support, and give it a good 3 months. So say if mental health is the number one thing that someone's suffering right now, probably talking to a psychologist or counselor is going to be the best place. And then, for example, someone with digestive symptoms being their number one thing that's impacting them, a dietitian's a really good person. So to come back to your question, we love to have what's called like a toolkit of people that people can reach out to, because it's outside our scope of practice to teach or to really help someone beyond nutrition. So we actually do what's called like guest expert workshops with our clients. So every month we host workshops and we bring in someone to speak on whether it's nervous system regulation or acupuncture, or even we've had someone talk about gut-directed hypnotherapy. And then that way they get a little taster into one, learning about this thing that they maybe have never heard of and how it can help them, and then two, connecting them with someone that we trust that could be a great resource for either support after they finish working with us or in tandem with.
I think you touched on something that was really great advice, but also you touched on something there that I think a lot of people find really difficult, that you need to stick with it for a little bit of time. And I think that is overwhelmingly difficult for a lot of people, because they want a really quick answer, whether that be medical, surgical, dietary, physio, psychology. They want it to be quick, and I totally get it. Like, if something is taking over your life, you want the answer to be quick. But I think when you said you need to stick with it for at least 3 months, I was like, yes, you do.
It's easier said than done. The whole 75 hard challenge that's going around at the minute, I've started it 4 times. I've never got more than 10 days in.
It also highlights, I think, that, you know, having the right support is something that you need to be able to stick with something. Like, you know, you need to believe that what you are taking is actually going to be beneficial. So, you know, if you've just had like a 2-minute really quick consultation and it didn't really get explained to you, you're not going to stick with that, whatever it is that's been recommended from the toolkit of things for all your various symptoms. So it's like, really, it's hard, because I think, you know, women have waited so long often still for a diagnosis. They want to get to that clinic and have their symptoms relieved quickly, but sadly it does still take quite a long time, because, as you said, there's lots of different, you know, 1 month it could be your mental health, another month it might be bloating, another month it might be something else. And I think I like the analogy of having a toolkit, and then, you know, what is your problem at the moment and what can we help with focusing on at the moment? But it's going to be a long journey to get everything under control, really.
That's right. And especially just to add, in menstrual health disorders, for example, it takes a whole month to have your period come around. So it's going to take at least 1 month to see, did what I implement this month make a difference for my upcoming menstrual cycle or my period? And so because it can take a bit of time to see results, you want to at least see, out of 3 periods, you know, out of the best of 3, did I see an improvement with this change or this strategy? And that's, and it's hard for people, because they will often change a million things at once, and then we can't quite figure out what was the thing perhaps. But that's okay. It's okay to do more than one at once, but be mindful of your energy and how much you can really take on at a time. And if you kind of scatter yourself over too many little things, you'll probably do none of them particularly well. Whereas if you just focus in on something, give it a good 3-month period and then move on to the next thing. Mm-hmm. You know, endo is a lifelong condition. It means you've got plenty of time to build that toolkit. And if you, 3 months actually in the scheme of managing a chronic condition is actually nothing. So sometimes we just need a little bit of a reminder that we overestimate what we can get done in a day and we underestimate what we can get done in a year. So take your time, go through the paces and definitely try and get referrals or recommendations to cut to a shortcut to someone who might be more knowledgeable, helpful in the endo space too.
Yeah,
definitely.
And from a nutritional standpoint, what would be your top piece of advice for someone with endometriosis that's tuning into the podcast?
Oh gosh, I mean, this is like the hardest thing, right? My top piece of advice, you know what, this is going to sound so basic, but honestly, sometimes the most basic advice is the best advice. Mm-hmm. What I see so few people doing is eating regularly. It is the number one thing that you can do to one.
Guilty.
I have breakfast this morning.
It's early.
No, look, and it's tough. We live in a really busy world where we've got deadlines, we've got busy schedules and families and all of this going on, but it is so, it's such a simple hack that we almost overlook it and maybe underestimate how powerful it is. But what happens is when you eat regularly, and when I say regularly, this means eating on average about every 3 to 4 hours across the waking hours of your day. So it's a breakfast, maybe around maybe 6 a.m., 7 a.m., then we're getting to lunch, or you might have a morning tea if your lunch is delayed. You might need an afternoon snack if dinner is quite late as well. And so when you eat like this, you tell your circadian rhythm that there's a regular schedule to what's going on. This impacts other hormones in the body. It tells your stress levels to reduce. It even tells your ovaries to produce adequate amounts of hormones. So I can't tell you enough how important regular eating is for hormones, but also for blood sugar level balance and the way you feel. So your mood and your energy throughout the day will be completely transformed when you eat regularly. And digestion. So if we don't provide regular nutrition into the body, the digestive system tends to slow down and become more sluggish. Mm. Something maybe you don't know is that estrogen is eliminated from the body through the gut. Many things are eliminated through the gut. We poop it out the other end. If our gut is sluggish and we have constipation, which is common in endo, we see more reabsorption of estrogen into the body through the intestine. Mm. And so, again, it's a hormonal improvement, but also a digestive improvement. So it's so simple, but just eat every 3 to 4 hours. If that's the only thing you do after listening to this episode,
I like that
I'll
advice.
Be happy.
I'll take it.
With eating every 3 to 4 hours, do you mean like a meal every 3 to 4 hours? Can it be like a snack between or...?
Definitely. So we recommend trying to have 3 more main meals per day, and you might have 1 to 2 snacks. And it kind of depends on the timing of all of that. But I find that people mostly need an afternoon snack because the time between lunch, maybe 12 or 1 o'clock, to dinner time, which could be 6, 7 or 8 o'clock, that's like
a long
time. It's like up to 7 or 8 hours without eating. Your body can't cope. And this is why people get the snackies in that.
This is why we nip down to the shop and get a chocolate bar. From your perspective as well, what is the best meal of the day? Which is the most important meal of the day?
Please don't say breakfast.
She's going to say breakfast.
You know what? It's not breakfast. Look, I love breakfast. And this is just my opinion. It's not based on any science. But I personally believe that dinner becomes one of the most important meals of the day because it's one of the only meals of the day that many people around the world actually eat vegetables. Mm. I think it's most people's favorite meal of the day because it's when they actually relax and sit down. Yeah. But
just to clarify, because for the northerners in England,
dinner is lunchtime.
So dinner is lunchtime at 12.
So you mean dinner in the evening, which we call tea.
Do you know what? That's so funny. So we say afternoon tea, we say morning tea, and I talk to the Americans and they're like, I'm not going to have a cup of tea. What do you mean? I'm like, no, not a cup of tea. Tea. Like, oh, God, sorry.
No, that's good.
We do call it tea. Like, well, yeah, we do, but it's probably less common here than it would be in the UK. Mm-hmm. So to clarify, Your evening meal, yeah. When we have a lot of veggies, yeah. It's when we also tend to get a good amount of protein. And look, that's just because I see people really nailing this dish. Where people need to actually probably improve on a lot more is bringing in a healthy breakfast and a lunch. Yeah. I find people are really struggling in those areas the most because that's when they're busy and they're rushing out the door.
It's the time pressure, isn't it? It's so hard to be prepared, to bring your lunch into work.
Can I just ask a quick question on the back of this? So you're saying it's really important to eat 3 meals a day and then you can have your snacks. You don't want you to be up and down with your blood sugars. And I feel like there's this massive drive at the moment for everyone to carry around the biggest water bottle that I have ever seen, ever.
Stanley Cup.
And I'm just kind of like, I feel like this
I'm so sorry.
This generation must be the most well-hydrated generation in the world. And I'm just kind of like, how much water is too much water, and how much water does one need? I just feel
is
like
is it that 2 liter real, or good, we
yeah,
should
yeah. yeah.
That's a great question, and you're right. It's kind of the big hype, and if you've ever heard of the 75 hard challenge, I think that's getting a bit of hype at the moment.
I haven't heard of it.
Oh, you're not on TikTok, are
we're
you?
So old.
What is it? Just a quick one for old people that don't know what it is.
I think you'll probably be a better explainer than me because it was like
trying to explain what you're trying to do.
There's set things that you're meant to do for 75 days because apparently it's proven that 75 days is the amount of time it takes to start a habit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right, okay.
So the things are
just,
drinking.
Just over two and a half months.
Yeah.
Which is
the
quite
things
wild.
Are drinking, well, I didn't do, I made my own note, but it was drinking 2 or 3 litres of water.
Yeah.
Doing 2 sets of 45-minute exercise.
One must be outdoor.
Yeah, I didn't do that.
Yeah.
I didn't do any of this. I didn't do 75 hard. Reading a book.
Yeah, you meant to read too many pages, drink so much, eat well,
eat some sort of diet. It doesn't have to be a healthy diet. Well,
I feel like
it doesn't
should
have to be cutting something out. You can choose the diet that you meant. It's just meant to be commitment, sticking to
something. Okay. So just a 75-day commitment
of trying to live your best life.
It's got a great philosophy. And look, I find it refreshing because you've just said 2 to 3 litres of water because my friend told me it said 4 litres of water. And I was just that is not good.
So is there too much then, as from a nutritional standpoint? What would you say is...
To bring it back to your question about water, you can actually calculate your individual hydration or fluid requirements per day. There's a simple equation, and it's a range of somewhere between 35 to 45 mils of fluid per kilo of body weight. So you just pop your body weight in there.
Actually, what we do medically with people that are inpatients for their fluid requirements.
Mm-hmm. Yes. This is what I used to do in the hospital back in
literally.
The day. Yeah. And if you do exercise and you sweat profusely and things like that, you want to add on an extra liter for every hour of exercise that you do.
Okay.
So most people, that's why the range sort of sits. You might need only 1.5 liters. Some might need up to 2.5 or 3 liters. It's very individual. Having too much can be, it's hard to get there, but anything more is not always better.
Mm-hmm.
We know that some people who've gone on silly, silly experiments or challenges where they've tried to scull stupid amounts of water in a short period of time, they've ended up in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So mindful, that's probably up to the 10 liter mark. Not many people are doing this, but you don't need to overdrink. But drinking regularly, I would say, again, if we go back to regular eating, regular drinking always is better than sculling water. So trying to sip regularly across the day, if you can. If you can't, try and just take a big glass every couple of hours.
Yeah, great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I was going to say, when I was trying to drink 2 liters of water every day, I was just going to the toilet every 10 minutes.
That's another thing, isn't it? Yeah.
So that's obviously been really enlightening, actually, and it's great to listen to somebody who works in a completely different way to us, but is in a complete kind of working along parallel, so that we've all got the same end goal, which is fantastic. So could you tell us about the services you offer for your clients currently? So you have the Endo Belly program, but we'd like to just kind of get a little bit of a gist about what this is so that our listeners could understand this program, if that's okay.
Yeah, amazing. So I built Beat the Endo Belly about 5 years ago, and it was created on the concept of dealing or helping people overcome or manage what I call the 3 hallmark features or the symptom drivers of endometriosis. So inflammation, hormone imbalances, and gut dysfunction. And so what I did was I've essentially created a step-by-step strategy where people can go through whether they need the FODMAP diet or not. That's very unique. An anti-inflammatory diet and then a hormone balancing strategy. And we actually walk with people through these steps. I call it a hybrid coaching program because we actually give them the education in an online format through video lessons and downloadable resources. But then we also hold their hand through it. So we have a group level where we go through it as a group. And then we also have a one-to-one container where we take people through in a more tailored or VIP kind of format. And so the outcome of this program is to help people reduce period pain, bloating, funky poops like constipation, diarrhea, and fatigue. I mean, obviously this is our like flagship program. I'm obsessed with it. It's something like, as you said before, it can't be done overnight. It's not a magic pill. It's not a quick fix. Mm-hmm. And it will be something that we take people through over at least a 3-month period. And for some people up to 6 months. Mm-hmm. So if anybody is stuck with those types of symptoms, they're looking for a holistic or a natural or something they can do for themselves to take back a little bit of control of their symptoms. They can come and talk to us. Either they can reach out on our website. We also have a free masterclass where we teach on the strategy we use inside Beat the Endobelly. So people can get a little taste to see what it's all about, and if it feels like a good fit, they can apply for the program, have a free call with me to see if it is a good fit. I do like a little mini assessment with them, and then they can join the program if it's a good fit.
That's great. I'm a big believer in anything that people think help themselves, then I am totally with it, because we have a lot of people, as I've said, that will come and say, I've tried acupuncture, I think it's helping. I'm like, keep going then. Mm. Or I've tried, you know, like, then if it's something that's helping you, then you need to be in the right headspace for that. Mm-hmm. I think if it's something you can stick at with and that you can afford, because I think we have to think about these things, like we work in the NHS, which is free point of care, but a lot of these things are add-ons, but some people have been desperate, and instead of throwing money towards things that are kind of quick fixes potentially that aren't very quick or fixable, mm-hmm. They should be kind of thinking about where it's best to put any money.
Definitely. And I think that's where like educating yourself and getting knowledge in these kind of formats is really useful, but also knowing that a lot of the information that you've shared is evidence-based is also really, really crucial, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we've said knowledge is power.
Knowledge
is power. Advocate for yourself.
Our motto.
I think because we believe in that, like mm-hmm. having that knowledge mm-hmm. and question people. As you said before, people were coming to you and they didn't know what the problem was. People are now going to healthcare providers and saying, I think I have endometriosis, I have these symptoms. So there's a different shift, and it kind of keeps clinicians on their toes, which I think is good.
Good.
Should be up to date. We should be knowing the evidence. We should be able to advise people at the best care.
Yeah.
And things like these give us another kind of a little thing for our armory to be like, well, have you tried something completely different? And I think that's a good option.
Yeah, definitely. Like you said, just to touch on at the very beginning of this episode, you talked about people who are trying to start a family, they need to come off hormonal medications. Yeah. And a lot of these people are terrified because this hormonal medication has saved them.
Yeah.
It's either completely, you know, stopped their periods for a temporary period of time. They don't get those big flare-ups of symptoms. And so coming off hormonal therapy to start a family, we need to look at what other tools people can add in to manage these symptoms so that they aren't, you know, so that they can go forward and go for those dream life goals that they have. And I'm sure you guys know better than anyone, anybody who's going and having multiple surgeries usually ends up with some more issues. They may end up with more adhesions or scar tissue and things. And so the role where I see diet really fitting is not only just helping someone feel more in control or a self-management strategy, but facilitating fertility goals, facilitating even just extending the time between needing an excision surgery, and even just feeling better, because fatigue is obviously a huge one that impacts so many people. Everyone's walking around like zombies with endo, in my opinion, and they can feel a lot better.
Studies that we've done were previous like questionnaire studies and various different things have shown that fatigue and bloating are the main symptoms that people actually are concerned about and that are affecting their lives, which we were like, oh, we totally thought that it would be pain or unable to have intercourse, or like we were a little bit sidelined by, we didn't kind of quite grasp a couple of years ago that these were going to be the main symptoms. And then when they're the main symptoms, you're like, oh, how are we going to help bloating and fatigue? Because actually, you know, we're not going to be experts at helping either of these things, I think. So we have a few, we like to do a little bit of a myths section, if that's okay. So we're going to try and bust a few myths quickly. So we will hand over to Lorna and Eleanor. Go, go, go.
Yeah, so one of the myths is dairy products can cause endometriosis or make it worse.
So no, we have zero clinical, direct clinical evidence that that's true. In fact, we only have one study that was ever done on dairy and endo, and it shows that people who consumed more than three portions of dairy per day actually have a lower risk of endometriosis occurrence by about 18%.
Wow.
So if anyone's thinking about cutting out dairy,
don't.
Unless you're dairy intolerant.
Yeah, not for endo.
Whether, so you might prefer it because you are a vegan, you may have an allergy or an intolerance, and that's the only circumstance. If you're doing it for your endo, it may just send you down a rabbit hole that wastes your time.
Yeah, great.
Perfect. The next one is soy should be completely avoided because it increases your estrogen levels.
And I will try to keep this so quick, but we actually see... Soy, I love soy, right? So soy has phytoestrogens. It's a plant version of estrogen, which means that it's similar, but actually it's much more mild in its effects on the body. Now, in a body with endometriosis where we see higher levels of estrogen or natural, what we call like endogenous estrogen being produced, the plant estrogen coming from soy comes on in, it enters the bloodstream, it goes to the cell, and it lands on the receptor of the cell, blocking the natural endogenous estrogen from attaching and having its high estrogen effect on the cell. And so what ends up happening is it kind of like comes in, blocks it off, and has a mild estrogenic effect rather than a much larger estrogenic effect from natural estrogen. So I actually love to recommend soy for breast tenderness, PMS, heavy bleeding in periods and things like that, and it can be used in menopause as well. I won't explain that because I know this is a quick one, but don't cut out soy.
Perfect. Thank you.
A plant-based diet is the best diet for endometriosis, and is this like a one-size-fits-all scenario? Is it not true or...?
So a diet that is rich in plants is beneficial for endometriosis, and I can say most people will benefit from this, but that doesn't mean that vegan or vegetarian eating is better. And so, again, it's like more is not always better. We see a really important role of having meat and dairy products in the diet too. So, yes, focus on plants and whole foods, but don't feel like it needs to be a big extreme version. And if you find more plants trigger you and make you feel worse, because it does for some, we may need to just figure out what's triggering you first before we go to plant-based eating.
Okay, great. Nice. This one hopefully is a quick one, I'm not sure, but endometriosis can be solely treated through the diet. What are your thoughts on that one?
If it was, I would be a millionaire.
Collaborative, isn't it?
I say this with coffee in hand, but you must completely eliminate caffeine and alcohol to cure endometriosis.
So you don't have to completely cut it out. We find majority of people may find that larger amounts cause issues. So the alcohol overloads the liver, for example, and therefore the body deprioritizes removing estrogen and doing other functions. Coffee increases gut motility, increases anxiety. And so we find that people with endo are more sensitive to these foods, but you don't have to cut them out. Usually, like having a coffee first thing in the morning and then switching to decaf in the afternoon can be a really great way of having both options. And similar with alcohol, trying to just, you know, the regular advice, try not to drink too much. None of us should really be drinking too much.
Yeah.
Face it out with water.
Yeah, but not too much water.
Not for
me. And if you go, maybe red wine as a preference because it's got antioxidants.
Perfect. So when we find our myths, we always get some pretty wacky ones. So this one is endometriosis is caused by negative energy, and this can be fixed by just going vegan and reducing your stress levels in your life. Just that easily.
I just love it.
I just love to know where you found that one. That's a crazy one.
Honestly, TikTok. Yeah.
My gosh. No. So, well, look, reducing stress in your life will help most inflammatory conditions. Stress has a huge impact on the entire body, so I'll give a little bit of credit to that. But eating a vegan diet or focusing on particularly negative energy probably isn't really going to make the big change. So keep a bit more of a balanced approach, and, yeah, definitely reducing stress is always good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Next one, alkaline diets will dissolve your endolesions.
As the alkaline diet would be a millionaire if this also was true, and there's an incurable condition if anyone didn't know. But alkaline diets are just not good or evidence-based for anybody. Okay. The body tightly regulates a pH level. If we were alkaline or acidic, we'd be dead. So unfortunately, alkaline or acidic foods don't actually have an effect on the body like we, I think a lot of people think it does. Mm-hmm.
Perfect. And then our last one, having herbs like cinnamon and turmeric or apple cider vinegar shots, that kind of thing, will naturally cure your endometriosis.
So there is a little bit of literature on turmeric. It's never going to cure your endo, let's be clear about that. But we know that the active ingredient curcumin in turmeric can help to improve inflammation levels in the body and therefore may improve your pain. Cinnamon, probably not quite so much. But if I had to say, like, if someone's out there doing this type of shot, apple cider vinegar, cinnamon and turmeric, it's not going to cause you harm unless you drink silly amounts of it, because vinegar will upset your tummy after a while. So there's no harm in doing it, but don't expect it to make the big lifelong, I don't know, endo relief you're expecting.
I think all the questions that we've had that we were going to ask, I think we've covered.
Definitely.
I've just got one more final question. So we discussed about antioxidants at first and foods in antioxidants, and I feel like people would be screaming going, but what, which foods have got antioxidants in, which are the foods that we should be buying and should be eating? So I think that we should like name some foods that we think are really good foods to be eating, consuming on kind of a daily, weekly basis, so that we've got kind of a bit of an idea.
Definitely. So the most simple way to think about where you find antioxidants is, one, you find them in highly colourful foods, because antioxidants make a lot of colour. So purple foods, like you might see purple sweet potato, eggplant, I think you guys call it aubergine, probably. even like red onion. And so if you're thinking about an anti-inflammatory diet, instead of picking the white onion, you might pick the purple onion, and that's a great little anti-inflammatory swap. Green leafy vegetables are very brightly coloured, your reds, your oranges. So think carrots, pumpkin, you know, peppers, like all of these foods that are beautiful in colour, they all have antioxidants in them. So that's one tip. So we think fruits and vegetables, obviously. Another thing to think about is polyphenols. These have antioxidant properties. Polyphenols, and think of like phenols, like smelling. I don't know if that helps anyone remember it.
Smelly food.
We got it. Smelly food.
Smell good. So, and like this is why cinnamon and turmeric came up in your question before. So spices and herbs that have a lot of flavor, a lot of smell to them, they are very high in polyphenols. They help to reduce inflammation. You'll also find polyphenols in tea and coffee and red wine. That's why I mentioned that before. And this is why, you know, you don't have to cut out coffee, but minimizing maybe the caffeine amount.
Just swap it for red wine.
I don't know how we don't feel about that work.
No one would know in the mugs.
Very true.
And don't forget, I think, like when you think of antioxidants, that you do find antioxidants in fats as well. And so nuts and seeds and oily fish are really great sources of antioxidant fats too. So, that's where I would focus your attention. And my biggest advice on this is to do what I call like a crowding out method. And so by focusing on these foods, you think about what can I eat more of? What can I add into my diet? And the more you focus on what can I add, the more it tends to what happen, it essentially crowds out the more processed or inflammatory foods in the diet, because you're filling yourself up with so much of this good stuff. And when you look at it like this, it's what I call an abundance mindset. You focus on what can I have rather than what can't I have. Mm-hmm. And naturally it just shifts in that direction. So you're having more of the healthy stuff and less of the unhealthy without it feeling restrictive or a big change.
I prefer that way of thinking.
Yeah, that's much more accessible.
It's great.
Mm-hmm. One of the fertility consultants I work with always says you need to eat the rainbow, Nick.
Eat the rainbow.
And she's like, and you don't, so you need to eat the rainbow. I think it's a good way of thinking, and actually it's made it easy to think about what foods that you would try and target to
put into your diet, so maybe some of the other food shifts out of your diet, I think that's a really good way of looking at it rather than being restrictive.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, definitely.
It's achievable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is good. Is there anything, Christy, that you think that you'd like to cover or tell us or ask us before we go? I think this has been a fantastic session. I think it'll be so useful to our listeners. And it's been great. I've really enjoyed it so much.
It's been really enlightening. And I think you've explained everything in a really easy to understand way, which would be great for our listeners as well. So thank you so much.
Amazing. I appreciate so much you having me on, because more people need to know about how beneficial diet can be for managing endo. It might not be a cure, but it will make such a huge difference for symptom management. Yeah. And symptom management equals quality of life. You can live better with endo. You can what I call thrive with endo. Yeah. So it means that you live with endo, but you live in a way that you're no longer impacted every day or at least every month from symptoms that, you know, stop you from going to work or getting out of bed. Mm-hmm. And I just want to give people that sense of hope that that is possible. And we've worked with hundreds of people who've achieved exactly that. And if anybody out there is stuck, confused, wants to get out of the, I guess, influencer confused space on diet, come and watch our masterclass. I talk about evidence-based science for endometriosis nutrition. And if it feels like a good fit, you can always join our program too. But if at the very least you watch the masterclass to debunk all these myths and get on the right track with diet, that would just make me such a happy person. So if you come to our website, you'll see our webinar up there. It's free to attend. And yeah, just come and check it out.
Mm-hmm. We'll put the website in the link.
Yeah, we'll put the link on. I think you've just kind of given some really great realistic advice, which is what we really wanted. We wanted something that kind of people could like listen to and think, oh, I could achieve that. Yeah. I could do that. And I think this has been really great for that. So thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure. We've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as always, just do a quick disclaimer. So all the opinions that we've shared are our own and are not affiliated with where we work. And anything that we've said shouldn't really be taken as direct medical advice.
Yeah, and make sure you're following us wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a little 5-star review.
And make sure you're following the socials as well at Between Two Ovaries.
Thank you.